And welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cunniff, and our sponsor this hour is Team Power.
You cut me right out of that.
Yeah, I did. Totally. I'm just going to move right along, and hopefully I don't get interrupted. Our sponsor is Team Power. They're our local Kubota tractor dealer. They're up on Twinview Boulevard, 3119 Twinview Boulevard, and they do everything tractors there. It doesn't matter what the brand, bring it in. They can work on it. Parts, sales, they do it all up there. Their phone number is 226-9226. Give them a call, or you can get them on the web at readingtractors.com. Right now they're running a service special. You can give them a call, get it scheduled, and you'll get a discounted rate on labor to do your spring service.
And we all know how that happens. It's winter, it's winter, it's winter, bam, it's spring.
And it doesn't start, so mm-hmm. Then you're panicked, and yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, get it done now and get it done cheaper. So, Team Power.
Bingo.
Bingo. There you go.
Well, so we are chatting with Dr. Libby Stout. This is the second hour of a two-hour program with her. We called the show This Is Your Brain on Marijuana just because I remember when we were kids, they had that commercial with the frying pan. And it's weird. I had a fried egg on my way before we came here.
Oh,
it must have been subliminal advertising.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they'd crack that egg into a really hot skillet, and they'd say, you know, this is your brain on drugs. And I'm 57 or 8. I don't remember what I am. Anyway, I'm something like 57 or 58 years old.
Your hippocampus is strong.
My parents,
strong. You can't even remember how old you are.
What the hell? I'm just 92 average. I'm just 8 below. Anyway, I remember that because we did demonize drugs back then. And now we've got, you know, people want stores. Towns want to have stores and they think there's going to bring all this revenue. And there's a tremendous cost to society for making this readily available, treating it like a natural product that has no, effects. And this doesn't come with directions. I mean, you can't get a dry cleaning bag that doesn't have a thing that tells you not to put it over your face, but you can go buy 90. I mean, you ever see that? You know, your dry cleaning bag and says, this is not a toy. And I'm thinking, wow, who did they have to?
Yeah, somebody did.
You know, what caused
that? Put it over their head and died. And it's like,
exactly.
I didn't
know. I thought it was a toy.
Yeah. I give it to my kids.
But they can ingest, these drugs that are, for the people who missed the first hour and you're thinking, oh, pot, it's no big deal. I smoked pot in high school. Okay. Well, it was probably 2% THC. And now a lot of this stuff, especially in the edibles, is up to 90, 95%. And the stuff they're smoking is 28, 29. She was telling us
it's totally
different pushing
game.
For 40. So Dr. Libby Stout, our guest, is a board certified addiction psychiatrist and has worked in the addiction behavioral health field since 1990. So she deals with a lot of people who have addictions, and surprise, the product that's supernatural, oh wait, it's addicting. So
yeah,
people have to actually go into programs.
At 2% it wasn't so much, but at 28,
then it was just a bad habit. You know, at 2% everybody
stupid, and you know that, you know, live with
like
it.
The song we played last time, and then I got high, and then
now you're talking addiction, and a whole different set of problems come along with that.
So I would recommend you go back and listen to the first hour if you haven't. Send it to a friend. You can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us, and she has an excellent document on there, The Problem with Current High Potency THC Marijuana from the Perspective of an Addiction Psychiatrist. There's also a 27-minute video of a program she did in Mount Shasta here in Northern California, the first part of February here in 2019. And it's got all of her slides. The slides were super interesting, and Robert has done an excellent job of putting the slides in there so it's not just a blurry, fuzzy thing with a pointer shining on it. They're really good, and you can go learn some stuff. I also have like a sneak preview from a guy named Ben Court. I have his video from that same workshop is on there, and we'll have him on in the future. He kind of deals with this from the addiction standpoint and from a user standpoint, so that'll be interesting, too. We're going to continue to pound away at the Marijuana Isn't Good For You program. But we were hooked on our own drug here. We were hooked on the hippocampus.
Yeah, we were talking about the effect of marijuana on the hippocampus. And you were saying that that regular use actually shrinks that part of the brain. My question is, if you get off of it, does does it ever, like, grow back, or have you done permanent damage?
And kind of tread, you know, kind of go backwards for people who don't know what a hippocampus is or does.
Okay.
It's in the brain. Right. There you go. That's the end of my knowledge.
So the hippocampus is part of your limbic system. So it's deep down inside of your brain. It's part of the primitive, prehistoric part of your brain. And it's where you put all your new memory and learning. It's a very important part of your brain in terms of learning anything new and remembering things. Mm. Because pointers for everything you've learned get stored there. And then it triggers how to pull it out of your long-term memory storage bank. And so, as I said before, there's new cells being born and differentiated all the time in your hippocampus, except when you're using addictive substances chronically, and this is all addictive substances, so alcohol, marijuana, THC, nicotine, opiates. So if you're using them chronically, you can actually shrink the hippocampus.
Can you get just a teeny bit closer to your phone? Libby, you're faded out a little bit.
So you actually can shrink the hippocampus. And so imaging has shown this. Now, we don't know exactly yet because all this stuff with the high-potency THC is really new, and don't have a whole lot of research on it yet. But there was a study I saw that was on chronic heavy marijuana users. So these are basically people that use every day. And they compared people with high THC marijuana to people with balanced CBD and THC to people that have been abstinent for like at least 29 months. And they found that, of course, the people with the high potency THC had the smallest hippocampus. The people that were using with the balance of CBD had less shrinkage. They still had shrinkage, but they had less shrinkage, which kind of supports the idea that maybe CBD is somewhat protective to THC.
And how does the CBD, so for those people who pretty much never intend to do this but would like to warn someone else, how do those two interplay, and how would you take them? You know, what do they come in the form of?
There's not that much known about this yet, but some of the stuff I've seen basically says that CBD may be allosterically knocked the THC off the receptor. The CBD doesn't bind to the receptor that's in the brain, but maybe knocks it off the receptor, because the THC binds pretty strongly. And as I said earlier, it's a long-acting chemical. It's not like our natural anandamides that are used and then destroyed immediately.
And it isn't like alcohol where, you know, you drink, you might have a hangover or something, and then it's over and done.
Right. Yeah, alcohol is gone pretty quickly. THC is not. THC hangs around a long time. And so, but what the study showed was that the people that had been abstinent from marijuana for 29 months or more, actually their hippocampus grew back to normal size.
Oh.
The only problem with that study was they didn't do any functional testing. So we don't really know yet, is it totally back to normal? Like it works just as well as it ever did?
Maybe the lights are on and no one's home?
Yeah, well, at least we know it's growing back, so that you're having neurogenesis again, which is good. That's great. And some of the other things that I think are really fun facts, because this is what I do in my program, is one of the best things to increase neurogenesis in the hippocampus is voluntary exercise. So the more you can get somebody to exercise, the better for their brain.
Hmm. And the more pot they smoke, the less exercise they get, typically.
Right. And so that's why in my program you have to quit everything. And then we have rec therapy every single day, and you're supposed to go work out every single day.
Hmm. And does that make it, does the exercise part of it make it easier on the rehab? I mean, as far as withdrawal or, you know, the symptom of withdrawal, does the exercise improve that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think exercise improves everything.
Huh.
And of course, it has to be voluntary. You can't force somebody to do it, or then that's stress. Because another thing that shrinks the hippocampus is stress.
Uh-huh.
So if people are traumatized or involved in a traumatic relationship or a very stressful situation, they also have difficulty learning anything new because their hippocampus is shrunk.
Wow.
Well, this is probably why pot isn't that good for people with PTSD, which we'll be getting to here in a little bit.
You're stressing me out, dude. Yeah.
Go in the other room, dude.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a quick break because now we've lapsed into silliness.
Okay.
Take a quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Libby Stout. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And that is what happens. All those years went by wasted. Bad deal. So, I know you're, I guess I should let people in on our little conversation there at 1 o'clock. She's like, I didn't know there were this many songs about pot. I'm like, oh. It was like I had a list like 30 long. I'm like, oh, man, I don't have that many breaks. there's a plethora, and actually songs about alcohol, I mean, as you would normally figure, there are just zillions of them, and lots of things you didn't listen to them like that before. But when you do a search, all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, I guess it could mean that.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
Yeah.
And so this list you have on the article was really, I thought, interesting, that with the increased potency of THC, that the recognized withdrawal syndrome, which includes increased anger, irritability, depression, restlessness, headache, loss of appetite, insomnia, and severe cravings for marijuana. It's like, well, those all sound great, but how many people do you have that come into your practice? Because I know you told a story in the workshop, and you had said that people come in and they're like, oh, I can't sleep. You're like, well, quit smoking pot. And they're like, oh, I just can't sleep. Pot makes me feel better. And then they come back in, you know, I quit smoking pot, and gosh, I can sleep again. Does that just happen all day long?
Yes, yeah. I see so many people, and this isn't in my addiction treatment program. This is in my work in the community, just as a psychiatrist for people that have, you know, medical problems, and they're referred to see the psychiatrist because they have psychiatric issues. And I invariably see the same thing over and over again. People, they're complaining all of these symptoms. They can't sleep. They're anxious. They're depressed. And I get the history that they're vaping like 60 to 70% THC oil, or they're eating edibles, or they're smoking dab. And
yeah,
I tell them, you know, I think all of your problems are your marijuana use. And they tell me, no, that's my medicine. And I said, well, then why are you seeing me? Well, you need to give me my medicine.
Yeah, not that medicine.
And so, because your one example was somebody who had come to you for like a year and then finally quit smoking pot, and their life totally turned around. It was like an epiphany. You're like, I had that epiphany a year ago.
Yeah, well, it's a really hard sell, because people do think that it's helping them. But the only way I can get people to see that it's not is for them to quit. But it's a really hard thing to do, to get people to do.
Yeah.
How long do they have to be off it before they start to notice a different? I realize everybody's, you know, wired different, but ballpark.
Yeah, it's going to be different, but it's still a long time relative to other things. I mean, most people, like if I treat somebody who's addicted to alcohol, normally within a month they're back to feeling pretty normal. Like there's kind of resolution of their symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But for marijuana, it takes a whole lot longer.
What one of the things you talked about in your article is the use of marijuana in the treatment of PTSD, and yet there's been no verifiable studies that show that it actually helps. Talk to us a little bit about that and what the actual result is when using that for PTSD.
Yeah, well, very good point, because it all the stuff that's out there is anecdotal. So there's all kinds of people that say, oh, it really helps me. But there has been no real study. And I know there's some in the works, but I haven't seen the results yet. I'm waiting to see what the results are. But no legitimate study, and it's all anecdotal. And my point with this is, it's anecdotal just like alcohol. You know, most people find that alcohol helps their PTSD. It doesn't help it in the long run because they get addicted to it and then they have all kinds of problems because of alcohol. But, and the VA learned the hard way with benzos. So they were using benzos for all these people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan to help with their post-traumatic stress disorder with horrible results. But it initially works because it numbs you, and that's exactly what the marijuana does. It numbs you. So, yes, while you're experiencing the symptoms, you can smoke marijuana, and the symptoms are gone, basically, because you're numb, you don't care.
Right.
However, then it wears off, and the symptoms are right back. So you have to keep smoking in order to keep the symptoms at bay.
And I think that's where people say it's good for PTSD is because it does. I mean, it's a bad deal, and if they can smoke it and feel better,
it feels like it's going the right direction.
It feels like you're helping, but the minute you stop smoking it, it's not making it go away. It's not really addressing. It's just it's treating it. It's not really
well. And you run the risk because you know, you increase depression. I thought it was interesting. I know there are not a lot of like young girls that have PTSD, so we're sort of blurring the line here. But there was one part in your article that said they found that girls who use marijuana at least once a week were twice as likely to develop depression than those who didn't use. Those who use marijuana every day were five times more likely to suffer from depression.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a teenager at home who's depressed, you know, before you put them on some medicine, real medication, you might want to check and see if they're using pot.
Mm-hmm. But I guess
absolutely true. Because the thing with the post-traumatic stress disorder, yes, it does work. But I want people to know that PTSD is curable. You can completely recover from PTSD if you get the appropriate treatment. Marijuana is not treating it. It is just numbing it. It's masking the symptoms so that the PTSD is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And so and it continues. And one of my real big concerns is the huge correlation we're seeing with suicide and the use of marijuana. And again, is that causation? Who knows? But the correlation is huge. And there's a very big study out of the VA looking at cannabis use disorder and the increase in suicide. And
and what's cannabis use disorder? Like what?
Well, that's the addiction. That's, you know, we now in DSM-5, we don't use dependence or addiction anymore. We call them use disorders.
Oh, brother.
So cannabis use disorder is basically somebody who is addicted to cannabis. And so this study out of the VA was over 3,000 veterans, and they were following them for whether they were using cannabis or not, if they had a lifetime history of suicide attempts or not. And they found a significant increase in suicidal ideation with the people that were using cannabis and an increase in lifetime suicide attempts. That was a dramatic difference. And so the other thing that I have really difficulty with, and I see this a lot with people that we work with, because I will get somebody who cannabis is their drug of choice, and almost everybody that goes through my program has significant post-traumatic stress disorder kind of stuff. A lot of it is multi-complex trauma that happened from childhood on up, and so they have a lot of trauma issues. And what I've found is sometimes we think we're working on an issue that really happened, and it turns out it's a delusion that they're never... This incident that we're trying to help them resolve actually never happened the way they think it did, because
wow,
it's become part of their delusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was just seeing that as a weird thing. But then there's a study out there that totally supports what I'm seeing, and it's about false memories. And the paper is entitled
"Sounds
Telling
Like the Kavanaugh
True
Hearing."
From False. Cannabis users show increased susceptibility to false memories. And the way they studied this was they compared 16 heavy cannabis users to 16 matched cannabis naive controls. And then they had the cannabis users abstain from cannabis use for 4 weeks. And then they did this memory paradigm test where they put them in an MRI scanner and they gave them 20 lists of 4 words, so they had to memorize the words. And while they're in the MRI, they asked them was this word on the list? And what they found was the people that used marijuana were much more likely to falsely recognize a word. Like they'll say, was this word on the list? And they say yes. And they'll say, well, no, sorry, that was not on the list. But the most dramatic part of that was they were much more likely to refused to accept that. So they would not reject that. So it was like, was this word on the list? Yes, it was. Well, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't. Yes, it was.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And
you were late
so
yesterday. No,
scary.
I wasn't.
Yeah.
So then I that's wonder, spooky. You know, how do you treat people's trauma if the trauma is actually a delusion that was created by the psychotic part of induced by marijuana? That's scary.
Hey, that's when you have to go get a comfort pig. Oh, sorry, that was just something I dealt with last week. Oh, we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Libby Stout. We are chatting about how marijuana affects your brain. Stick with us.
A jukebox song ringing in my ear. The next thing you know, the bartender's pouring, shots are flowing, got me stoned, and all I really know is that I should be going, but I'm soaking up the moment. I'm all jacked up, all jacked up. Don't believe I've ever had this much. One thing I've learned: when you get tore up, time sure flies when you're all jacked up.
In a stem, you can bake it in some brownies, smoke it through a ball, roll up a great big fat one like old Cheech and Chong, burn it through a hole in a can of Budweiser. If you can't take the heat, son, vaporize it. And oh, wacky tobacco, when you feel it creeping up on.
Even Toby Keith is in it.
That's right. Wacky to backy.
I'm not kind of a catchy tune, though, so I had to use that one. So on the PTSD thing, you know, we just don't want to let that go too quickly, because that's a really big thing, and I think people are being really grossly misinformed because I hear veterans tell me all the time that their doctor at the VA told them they should start smoking marijuana. But there's a line in your in that PDF we have online. I guess I haven't given the website in a while. It's at wethepeopleradio.us, and you can just read it online or download it. But this document that's on here that you had written, those who were using marijuana but stopped using it in treatment had the lowest level of PTSD symptoms 4 months after treatment. But those who started smoking marijuana had the highest levels of violent behavior and PTSD symptoms 4 months after treatment. I mean, that was one of those where I was like, did I just read what I think I read and go back, do it again?
Right. There's not any
that's
real
bad.
Good studies out there showing the benefit of marijuana for PTSD, but there is this big observational study that they did out of the VA where they observed over 2,000 veterans that were treated in VA PTSD treatment programs around the country. And they just compared them based on their use of marijuana. And so the PTSD treatment program is like an inpatient 1 month program, and then they followed them for 4 months after that. And they found that the people that never used marijuana had significantly lower symptom severity, meaning the PTSD treatment helped them. The people who stopped using marijuana actually had the lowest level of PTSD symptoms after 4 months of treatment, so they did the best. And the people who started smoking marijuana had the highest levels of violent behavior and PTSD symptoms 4 months after treatment. So even though they had been through treatment, they didn't benefit from it, and marijuana was making them worse. And this is, you know, just an observational study. So this is actually what happened with these people.
So what is treatment? I mean, what's the alternative to marijuana on this PTSD thing when you say they underwent treatment?
There's several evidence-based treatments that work quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, a lot of people use cognitive behavioral treatment. There's prolonged exposure therapy, which is used a lot in the VA. And the thing that we use in my program that I think is the best is EMDR, or eye movement desensitization reprocessing kind of treatment, which is using, you know, tracking eye movements across the corpus callosum. I can explain how this works scientifically, but this is kind of outside the scope of this.
Right.
But we've already admitted that we don't have the vaguest idea what you're talking about.
But these are treatments that actually can cure the problem.
Sure. Right.
And people can recover completely from post-traumatic stress disorder. But it takes work, and there's no magic pill, and there's no magic thing you can smoke that makes it all go away. You have to process it. So it's a way of processing the memories and changing them. It doesn't make the memories go away, but it makes the memories more,
acceptable.
Adjustable, like you can
just less debilitating.
Right.
Well, all of these things that are, I mean, this is a, you know, fairly long document that you have gone on to say, I mean, once you kind of move through the PTSD part, it said multiple studies have documented a relationship between cannabis use and suicidality. A large study in Australia and New Zealand of over 2,000 adolescents found almost a sevenfold increase in suicide attempts in daily marijuana users. I mean, that's
significant.
Because our teen suicide, I think it was Ben Cort in his, did he talk about it or did you? Somebody was talking about the teen suicide at that presentation earlier in the month. And I was blown away by the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, they're significant. And if you look at the data out of Colorado, the number one drug in teen suicides is marijuana.
They'll say
all the time, marijuana never killed anybody. Alcohol kills people all the time. It's like,
yeah.
Okay.
In the Colorado, this is from the Public Health and Environment Department of Colorado. The marijuana is the number one drug in toxicology in suicides from adolescents 10 to 19. And alcohol is the next highest, but it's not as high as marijuana.
Wow.
Which, again, it goes back to causality. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean...
With every kid, but still.
But
if
still,
you're a parent,
it's present, yeah.
If you know parents out there who are falling under this spell of, well, you might as well let your kid smoke pot, it's better than alcohol, and, you know, that kind of... And everybody does it, and it's no big thing, and I used to do it back in the 60s or 70s. I don't think they realize the risk profile has... I mean, now there is a
changed
risk profile.
Dramatically.
Yeah, I mean, there really wasn't one a long time ago.
Right.
Your article also says here, misguided marijuana advocates have recently been suggesting marijuana is a solution for the opioid epidemic. I wanted to make sure we didn't skip over this part. Yeah, which is like, basically,
bizarre.
You didn't say this, I did, but it's pure fiction.
Yes, and it is pure fiction. I mean,
oh, good. Now you say it.
You just have to look to Colorado, because, I mean, there's several things that have made me very concerned. The fact that we actually publish things before people actually get real data. Like, there was what I think was really irresponsible reporting in the American Journal of Public Health, which is a reputable journal, but these people back in 2017 reported about... they said that recreational cannabis legalization and opiate-related deaths. So they published this curve, which showed continually increased opiate-related deaths. And then in 2014, when we legalized recreational marijuana, and then they show this slight line going back down, where they say, "Oh, look, it stopped the deaths from re." But You don't report something with just 1 year data. I think they needed to wait for 3 more years. And then the other thing was, 2014 was when in Colorado we mandated the use of the PDNP, where doctors had to look it up to see who all is getting prescribed opiates by other people. And the reality is...
Yeah, that would lower the deaths, wouldn't it?
The opiate-related deaths just continued to rise. And so, yes, in 2014, there was kind of a leveling off to 2015, and then it just has continued to rise. So in 2017, we had the greatest number of opiate-related deaths we have ever had in Colorado, and we've had marijuana available since 2000. So it isn't making it better. And one of the things I think is... kind of funny, there was a study, and they weren't really trying to, I think, find a treatment for this, but this was marijuana users who were not treatment seeking, and they just wanted to see if naltrexone, which is an opiate blocker, affected their marijuana use. And so they were in a laboratory setting where they were allowed to smoke as much marijuana as they wanted to, and they were monitored, and all they had to do was take a pill, either a placebo or the naltrexone, the opiate blocker. And they found that those that got the naltrexone used significantly less marijuana than the people who weren't. So basically, that kind of shows that the opiate receptors and the marijuana receptors work kind of together in the brain. And then there was a study these were on products of abortion. So these were fetuses that were from women who had abortions. And they looked at the difference in the brain circuitry of the fetuses that were exposed to marijuana during the pregnancy to those that had no exposure to marijuana. And they found that the opiate-related genes were significantly different in those ones exposed to marijuana. And we don't know what happened to those babies, but it's very similar to rat data that shows if you give a pregnant rat marijuana, their offspring are much more likely to push the lever for heroin than if they were not exposed to marijuana.
So marijuana is not an opioid, but it affects the opioid receptors in the brain the same way. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Like when they're smelling, you know, the pot smoke and all that, and then all of a sudden they try something and they're magic, you know, they're addicted.
Right.
And the one that's most compelling to say that this is, you know, absolutely not the solution, it's going to make it worse, is this really huge study that was using NESCAR data. So this is national data where they're getting data from over 34,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at people in wave one, which were 2001 to 2002, and looked at their cannabis use in that period. And then in wave two, looked at their opiate use, which was 2004 to 2005. And what they found was that people had no cannabis use, basically had no opiate use. The occasional users of marijuana had more opiate use, and the frequent users and very frequent users had significantly more prescriptions of opiates that they received. So to think that giving people marijuana is going to decrease their opiate use is crazy. It's just not going to happen. And I think it's not good for public officials, and I know even famous physicians, you know, have come online in news shows saying, yes, they support this. There's no data out there that supports it, and the data that is out there says bad idea.
That it's all wrong.
So well, do you think maybe they're thinking that way to...
Hold on, we have to take a quick break.
Replace the opioid with marijuana?
Bill doesn't smoke pot, so he'll be able to remember his question until after the break.
Okay.
This is a test. This is the hippocampus break for Bill. You're listening to We the People. We'll be right back. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
When I've had a bad day, no prescription, honey, when my skies are gray. No popping the pills, no smoking the pills to make me feel okay. You go down easy, baby, I could drink you by the case. You're my painkiller. A little dose of you goes a long, long way.
Downside. He's throwing up. So much for that fun romanticized version. It's over now.
Yeah. So my question here, just so I'm clear on this replacement of marijuana with the opioids, are they saying...
Reverse that.
Yeah, replace the opioids with marijuana.
Failed the hippocampus test.
Oh, jeez. Are they saying that is a treatment to get off opioids because it's better to smoke marijuana than take opioids? Is that...
Yeah, what is the logic there?
What is the logic?
Well, that has been the logic.
Oh.
I mean, there's been no studies showing that. I do think that when pushed, people will say that, well, what they're really recommending is CBD. I haven't seen the data. I haven't seen anybody do real research on that to show that CBD decreases the use of opiates. But, you know, they're saying that CBD can be helpful for pain, so...
Yeah, what about that? Are there studies on that? Because I have a associate, let's say, that wanted to look into CBD.
Is this one of those friend stories?
Yes, it's a friend. They had... they work with their hands, and they have a lot of arthritis pain, and somebody recommended the CBD oil for that. Is that a legitimate treatment?
Well, that's what we don't know. I mean, I would love to see the real legitimate double-blind placebo-controlled trials that show in large numbers that it really is effective, but they're just not out there.
Right.
And there are some things on CBD that are coming out that are showing benefit. But part of the problem is if you're talking to the people in the cannabis industry, they want the whole plant. They think that the entourage effect is what's important. So
right.
you have to have the terpenes and the CBD and the THC and everything. And that's like almost impossible to study really effectively.
Just too many moving
so people
parts.
Are trying to look at, you know, CBD. But also one of the problems is because there's not really good regulations, a lot of these products out of dispensaries are not well tested.
Right.
And since the plant has this phenomenal ability to suck up bad things in the soil, like heavy metals, I mean, that's a good thing for the plant. Like, hemp can actually clean up a soil area. However, it gets into the plant, and then if they're not testing the plant for heavy metals, people are then smoking it, and they're getting heavy metals in their system,
right?
which is not good for you. Or they're using the oil.
Now, the CBD oil, there's no high associated with CBD. It's only the THC that actually makes them feel good. Is that right?
Well, that's the common thought. Currently, yes.
Okay.
Until they figure out how to do something and jack up the CBD.
Yeah, it's just really hard to know. And, you know, my big focus has been mostly on this really high-potency THC stuff because that's where we're seeing all the really bad problems.
Right.
And I just don't know how we fix this because there should be regulations on it. There should be limits on the level of THC. And these concentrate products, I don't know what they're good for. I don't know any research out there that says smoking dab is good for anything medically.
And what is that
available.
Even?
What is that? I've never heard of that.
I've heard of it, but I've seen the pictures of it you guys had, but what does it do? It looks like peanut butter.
Well, yeah, it's just a highly concentrated product of the THC.
And you light it on fire?
They have to extract the THC, and they do that through oil, usually, butane or propane.
Supernatural there, you know,
dioxide.
Butane.
Mm-hmm.
What I want
to they,
put in my
they
body.
Have to extract it, and then they concentrate it way down, and it can be a gummy substance, or it can get, like, peanut brittle. And then they smoke those things. And usually people are smoking them with a blowtorch.
What?
Mm, yeah. That should be
with
good for
you. With a blowtorch? Wow. yes. And so now that everybody has a real clear picture in their mind, near the end of the article it says, if states continue to commercialize marijuana, as has been done in Colorado, we're destined to see many more people requiring treatment for, I'm thinking, burns, but addiction, depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, and psychosis, in addition to probably blowing up their house and lighting their furniture.
Yep.
I mean,
well, there's so many communities that are on kind of track to do what Colorado's done.
And they all think they're going to get all this tax money.
And there should be enough data out there to prove one way or the other whether that was a good move for Colorado. Sounds like maybe
well,
not.
It does bring money, but it's mostly bringing money to the people that own the dispensaries and the people that are growing the plants.
Right.
I mean, the people thought it was going to bring all this tax money that was going to be usable, but in Colorado, it's less than 1% of the budget. So,
right.
I mean, it's...
But they also have to factor in the increased medical...
Yeah, the rehab and the emergency room and...
Exactly, the consequences. Exactly.
Well, the lack of productivity of your youth, I mean, potentially creating
right.
a wasted generation, no pun intended.
Well, and the fact that you can't hire people. I mean,
yeah.
There are a lot of safety-sensitive positions that have to interview thousands of people to get enough people to be considered for a job because they can't pass the drug test.
Well,
and we're seeing that here.
We're seeing that here.
Spades.
What was the number on the
Highway Patrol?
Highway Patrol was.
Highway Patrol had 650 positions at that time. It's not that long ago here, in the last 6 months or a few months. And they said they'd go through probably 100,000 people to find those 650.
600 positions. That's incredible.
It's enough to make you want to, you know, you just kind of have to stop and think about that. We don't even have 100,000 people in our town.
Yeah.
We interview everyone in our whole town. It's pretty bad.
I agree. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
And so, Libby, what are you finding out there? Are people really hungry for the information? Or are you having to kind of like, hello, you know? You having to sort of beat the door down, or?
Well, I mean, once I start talking, people are like, I didn't know that. And why didn't we know this?
Right.
Before we legalized it and put it through our whole society.
Yeah. Because when I was in Canada, I went to another meeting up there for something else, but it was 10 days after they opened all the dispensaries. And so I just talked to everybody about it, so people sitting next to on the plane. And the people would, I just start telling them our experience. And the people would say, well, why didn't we know this? And because they found that there's two types of people. There's the people that are very pro-pot and they can't wait until it's legalized and available. And then there's the other group are the people that don't really know anything about it and they just don't care.
And they don't care.
And they think that, well, it doesn't affect me and maybe it'll, you know, if we legalize it, we'll get tax revenue and it'll lower the crime, and that doesn't happen either.
Right. And so then when I start talking to that group of people, they're the ones going, well, why didn't we know this? Why didn't we get told this? And,
Yeah.
That's the problem.
The industry does a really good job of making it all about how you hate cancer patients. And you're just mean and you know, puritanical.
This is why I wish we had a ban on any advertising completely.
That would be useful, too. Well, can you imagine? We have hit the end of the road here. Told you this would go too fast.
I know it would.
I think we'll have to chat with you more in the not too distant future.
I think I heard in Colorado they're talking about maybe legalizing mushrooms now. So we'll be talking.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
Yeah.
Our guest has been Dr. Libby Stout. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
We're at the bar and we're having us some beers and swapping out on cares, talking politics. Blonde and redhead chicks, old dogs and new tricks and habits we ain't kicked. We talked about God's grace and all the hell we raised. And then I heard the old man say, God is great, beer is good.